You are listening to Essence, a podcast about story, journey, and self.
There we go. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the show on this very early Monday morning. I have my guest, Jenna Tellandrew, here. Hello, Jenna.
Good to see you, Ben. Thank
it's
you
good
for
to
being
see you
so
too.
Early.
No, it's all good. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, right?
Not here
right now. And as you can see, my hair is on its own adventure right now, but we're not here to talk about my hair. We're talking about Jenna Tellandrew. So for those who don't know who Jenna is, and I adore Jenna, and I actually realize this is only the second time we've actually spoken in person like this. All the rest has been digital or through various kind of means. But Jenna Tellandrew holds an MA in Celtic Studies from the University of Wales, Trinity St. David, and has a bachelor's degree in archaeology. She is the founder of the Sisterhood of Avalon, an international Celtic women's mysteries organization. Jenna teaches four-day residential training retreats around North America and the UK, and facilitates pilgrimages to sacred sites in the British Isles and Ireland through mythic seeker tours. She's a frequent presenter and guest speaker at academic conferences, religious symposia, women's spirituality gatherings, and pagan festivals. A priestess in the Avalonian tradition for over 25 years, Jenna has been following a pagan path since 1986. Visit her at www.unisavalon.com and sisterhoodofavalon.org. And of course, as always, those will be down in the show notes. So I actually want to start out with something. Do you know when I was born?
Oh gosh. The year I graduated university.
1986. So you've been part of the pagan community for as long as I've been alive.
There you go.
So
I love that.
It's to kind of throw you off on this very early morning interview. It's a wonderful thing. So let's start with that then. Let's do your origin story, because I feel like a lot of people in kind of the Druid sphere and the Celtic sphere know who you are, but people just outside of that may not know that despite your real connection to the UK and Wales in particular, you're actually from Brooklyn, New York originally, right? Brooklyn?
New York. That's correct.
Yes.
And I often surprise people with my clearly American accent, but that is where I arise.
So why paganism? What brought you to paganism? Because you've had quite a journey through that, and we will of course get into that, but what attracted you to paganism?
Well, I think as a child, I loved mythology and wished I lived in the past. I have a love for history, ancient cultures. And So I used to wish I was born in the past so I could worship, the Greek gods. That was my foray into mythology. And then I used to, by accident, I used to get those Sidney Omar annual Gemini, astrology books. And I noticed there was a section right next to it. And I saw this book, and it was the Women's Spirituality book by Diane Stein, a Llewellyn book. And I was like, oh, what is this? And so I brought it home. And now I come from a very, my father was born in Italy. He's very, very devout Catholic. So there's a lot of reading underneath the covers. And it was an amazing book. It really informed so much of my life from that point, because when it comes to women's spirituality, especially in the 80s and the 70s, it's so entwined with feminism and politics and reclamation of women's bodies and spaces and all these things that so that was always very, very intertwined for me. So my beginnings were, and I self-dedicated when I was 16, using that book, and that was a path that I followed, this Dianic Wiccan path. But then again, living in New York City, and this was in the pre-internet age again, so the late 80s, I used to go and get my magical accoutrement at the Magical Child in Manhattan. And from there, I followed a flyer and found a coven in New York City, in Brooklyn, where I lived. So I was initiated there, but I knew it wasn't my path, but I was so excited to be with other people. I went in a very short period of time to thinking I needed to have lived 2000 years ago to this understanding that people are doing this here and now, that they're reclaiming, these traditions and worshiping these gods. And I was just so thrilled. And so it just went from there.
And here you are.
And I guess, and here I am. So I connected, I guess, in university with with a women's group that was doing this Celtic piece, kind of Babylonian, kind of Druidic, and so I was like, yes, this feels more like where I am. So that's where I dedicated, because I always loved Avalon. So I loved mythology, and I always loved Arthurian tradition. I was a very precocious child and just devoured, you know, these Arthurian novels, everything from Mary Stuart to all the people, E.B. White, all the things. But those two were very linked very early for me. And I read The Mist of Avalon when I was 13. So again, one of those things, need to live in Dark Age Britain, need to live in.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. So I think when I look back at where I stand now, so this is, you know, 35, 40 years later, because I'm an old.
Hey, I'm there. I feel you.
Well, yeah. I think we've established that I was 16 when you were born. So anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. So I guess my early was very intertwined, very goddess-centered, very, very woman-centered, very, you know, feminist, very, you know, politically. And not that, but that's a very strong foundation in my work. And where it brought me, you know, in my studies, I studied archaeology in undergrad, and then I did my master's in Celtic studies, as you mentioned. So there's been a shift in my work in but I think the heart and spirit connection, you know, I've always had these tools. I've studied different kinds of occult traditions and things of that nature. But I think you can see where the thread of the goddess center, the woman center, found its place in that Celtic tapestry. And the more connected I got to in the lore, in the, in the foundational, you know, the really hardcore academic pieces. What was delightful to me is that it, you know, it grew me as a priestess. It grew me as a thinker, but it's also validated so much. And not only that, elevated, because it's like, oh, I understand that now in a different way. Oh, okay. So it's moved me. So I learned enough to get in there and understand how to work with the materials, and then let the materials and let those traditions kind of continue to move me along its stream. So instead of looking to find it, it's like, all right, I understand enough to be able to let go. And so that's the metaphor.
That makes sense. No, that definitely makes sense. And knowing a little bit about kind of the pop cultural pieces that were also surrounding you at the time, like I remember a mutual friend of ours saying how much you love the Wheel of Time because of the Aes Sedai, or the Mists of Avalon because of that really goddess-centric. And I've always loved Mists of Avalon because that was my introduction to paganism too.
So many people,
right? Of course, we won't talk too much about that context, but yes. but I'm curious, because I know you've talked about it in other contexts, that strange dichotomy of not really feeling connected to like the Roman or the Italian tradition, really going into the Celtic. So I'm curious, do you mind if I ask you about that?
Sure, no.
What wasn't connecting for you with it?
So I think part of it is, I remember once when I first got into Wicca, I asked my father, do we have any Strega in our family? And he just about swallowed his tongue, like, you know, what are you talking about? But I know that, you know, like, so, you know, I am first generation in this country, and there are still Italian traditions in my family. My grandmother, my mother's mother, so she was second generation. She used to do this thing called the passing of the head, which was this way to calm a colicky baby. But you could only learn the prayer and the process on Christmas Eve at midnight.
Oh.
It's this really interesting piece. So there are these things that he looks at as very Catholic sounding, isn't it? But it really is this underlying folk magic there. But I think because there was something about the British Isles that caught me very early. Again, like I said, I was like 11, 12, 13, reading Arthurian stuff, watching Stark. I was just a giant, nerd before it was cool. So I have my hipster nerd credit. But that said, I have been to Italy. I mean, I've been surrounded with the Italian culture. You know, I speak Italian to, you know, a passable degree. And on the occasions that I've been there, I've opened myself. I said, okay, I'm in the land of my ancestors, literally gone to my father's hometown, just opened myself up to the experience. And the connection that I made with the divine there was not divinities, these local divinities. It was more the, you know, I kept seeing, you know, the divine mother in things, right. You know, that, you know, connecting with that stream, that seeing, you know, going to like the baptistry it doesn't matter, going to a church and seeing a statue of Mary and seeing, oh, that's a symbol of Astarte, that's a symbol, you know, pulling out all of these symbols. Oh, this is the tetragrammaton, seeing the ways in which the symbolism has. So that's what Italy greeted me with. So that, I don't know why that is. But then I'll go someplace like Anglesey, you know, the place where the Romans attacked and slaughtered the Druids. And I stand there, you know, on the bridge over the Menai Straits. And I'm like, okay, these are my ancestors that did this to your ancestors. But I felt so welcomed and received there in the land and, you know, felt, you know, I don't know. So I don't know what it is, but I've just been, I felt blessed along this path. I felt welcomed, but I do know that I am a guest. I do everything that I can to be as immersed as I can, given, you know, that I don't live there and that's not my direct, you know, ancestral heritage. Mm. But you know, the 23andMe results. who knows? There may be something there. But yeah, well, so, I don't know why.
Well, I like to ask that question of my guests, mainly because kind of my work being steeped in that ancestral piece, that mm-hmm. piece comes up again and again and again, that assumption of culture based on ancestry. Mm-hmm. And as you said, like, you grew up in a lived Italian culture, but, you know, the culture of Britain, really, that ancient connection, there's something there. There's a connection that transcends that ancestry piece. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of people need to hear that, because I feel like a lot of people limit themselves. But I also, that lived piece, like, I feel it too. I've lived in Canada for 30 years. Yes, I'm from there, but I've been away for such a long time. I don't know the actual living culture there yet, mm-hmm. not as a lived experience yet. So mm-hmm. it's an interesting piece, isn't it, around kind of that yeah. connection, but lived culture. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I do love Roman ancient history. I do love the Etruscan stuff. So yeah, but I appreciate your saying that. And yeah, I think you're right. There is this sense that, I mean, I guess it can be a good place to start when people are first embarking upon a path. I don't know where to mm-hmm. start. Let's look at, you know, where I come from. Let's look at that kind of heritage. But culture isn't in anybody's genes. It's a practice. It's something that is practiced. So you are born where you were born, but you're culturally Canadian right now from what you're saying. And so, you know, you have to transition back. So culture is, you know, where you're at. And I learned that very young, going to Italy for the first time when I was 14, and my cousin's saying, because here in this, I don't know how it is in Canada, but here in the States, people will say, oh, I'm Italian. And what we mean is, I'm of Italian descent, because I was very aware when I was in Italy that I was not Italian. I'm American Italian, which is like, I mean, again, first generation, so I'm very close to some of those things, but also, you know, live in America.
Yeah, the amount of spitting and this probably really took you back when you were in Italy, right?
I just know that one day I am just the right height to be one of those little Italian old ladies that, you know, sit on a balcony and watch and judge everybody all the time. I am gonna be central casting for that when I get to be 80 years old.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Well, that's like the dichotomy, isn't it? The judgy mm-hmm. or straganona, right?
That's right. I want to go towards more straganona, although spaghetti is not the extent of my cooking repertoire.
Right. So going to Italy at 14 then, and having that experience, I'm really curious then, what was it like for you to then first go to the UK? What was your UK experience like? I don't think I've ever actually heard this story before.
So it was in 1990. I was in university and a group of women that I was in a circle with and I, we all went, and we went to Glastonbury, and I wound up traveling there by myself, and we met up. We actually had a friend who had a friend who was living in Glastonbury. We rented a flat for a month, and I was actually in my last year of undergrad, but my professor was from Oxford, and she knew what I was. She's like, okay, don't worry, you make up the work when you come back. So I thought that was really, really cool that she allowed me to do that. So there we stayed. And so I So my first experience was getting off the plane and trying to get myself to Glastonbury, which, as we know, via public transport is can be a process. But I just remember being on this, you know, I was like, here I am, you know, double-decker bus, zooming through, you know, the Somerset countryside, past these really high hedgerows, and then there it was, the tour. And I just started sobbing. And it was a powerful thing. And I got to live there. It was about 3 weeks on the land there. And so, yeah, so I just went whole hog directly right into all of that. And Glastonbury is quite an interesting place energetically and what it pulls up for people. There's so much attached to that landscape. So it is a big giant, you know, mirror of the spirit. So there was a lot of growth and a lot of it was an amazing experience. But yeah, we just went, you know, and we did a lot of the stuff in the south. But anyway, so I didn't have the let's go to London thing until later.
Well, I mean, London isn't even part of England, let's be honest here. It's kind of its own separate thing, right? You know, it's like any big city. Like New York isn't really part of the States. Toronto isn't part of Canada, right? But
in our own pocket universe.
It's kind of its own pocket universe, exactly. That thing that you, well, that piece you said about Glastonbury brings up and is a mirror, I've often heard it being very similar to Israel in that way. People get that Israel kind of or Jerusalem complex in Glastonbury. And I know people who live there, it's a lived experience for them. Even they find every so often they get caught by it, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is it like for you now after all these years to go back? You obviously take people on pilgrimage there, people who may, this is their first experience, having come through maybe seminary, having gone through their year in a day and so forth. What is it like for you to be facilitating that process for people?
Well, I mean, first, it's nice that I've been there so often for over a period of time that, you know, I've had an evolution of relationship with the land, and it is an honor and a privilege to be able to facilitate those things for other people. So based upon the experiences that I've had there and what it's brought up in me, you know, I can come to it from a place of authenticity, but also have that historical background and the, you know, the understanding of the evolution of space and all of that. And, you know, to be able to hold both things at the same time, you know, to have it be this transformative experience, this, you know, liminal place that connects us with the otherworldly Avalon. And then also, you know, this is the history of the land. And this is how the lore and the legend came to settle here. And you need to, you know, acknowledge both pieces of that. And I think that's been, I don't know, a privilege.
Makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. It's actually, I can't even say that. I don't want to say that makes a lot of sense. I'm hearing what you're saying. I'm feeling it from my own perspective. Mm-hmm. But to really sit with that statement of it's a privilege, you know, I'm not sure I can fully appreciate that because I've never experienced in a situation like that. And I suppose in some ways that is the privilege piece, isn't it?
What do you mean? Because this is your land, so you don't feel that.
More of whenever I speak to somebody who has been able to lead a group of people through an experience like that, and they say it's a privilege, I'm just now starting to clue into the responsibility of that because of my book. And so I don't want to sit here and be like, yeah, that makes sense. I really want to give that respect and that and honor what you just said, because I can hear just behind that, yes, no, for you, it is a privilege. I hear that. Yeah, I really do hear that.
And I appreciate that. And I think that's the piece that I think, you know, we come from this perspective that we talk a lot about service in the sisterhood. Yes. And it is a service because I'm not there for me when I am facilitating a space. It's not about my experience. It's not about it's about holding that space, opening those doors, you know, facilitating, bridging those experiences for other people. So that's a bit of the shift too. And, yes. And I find that, you know, it's good to be rooted in that place and good to be rooted in it so that you can, you know how to hold that space for others in those other places. And it starts with where you are. It starts with where you are. So I think I think that's true across the board, whether you're, you know, doing something in your office or what have you, to find the privilege of being able to do that is to recognize, as you say, the responsibility and to step aside to know that this isn't for me, this is for other people. And when it is for you, it shouldn't be involving other people, if that makes sense. So
yes, that does make sense.
To row the boat, the other people are the ones who are on the ride, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. And in truth, that was kind of a tricky statement I said, because I was setting you up for the next question, which is, and I'm always curious about this, because I know I struggle with this piece, and I think many of our colleagues struggle with this. You have developed the Sisterhood of Avalon. You're the one of the facilitators of it. You're the originator of it. And so it's so tied to your own spiritual practice, but you also have your own spiritual practice out of that. How do you navigate between the two, your own spiritual practice, your own spiritual approach, and then this organization that you've built that facilitates it for other people?
I'm a Gemini. No, honestly, there you go, period, the end. No, I mean, I guess that's it. I guess I don't have an issue holding two things at the same time. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, I have developed relationships with deities that are not the focus of our organization. And, you know, I don't see it as an issue. And I think that, you know, one informs the other. You know, I feel like sometimes my practice is a couple of years ahead of where the sisterhood is. And part of it is because it's developing and I'm delving into it and I'm exploring it and I'm working it. And, you know, I bring in other of my sisters and we work it together and then we present it. So that's it, I think. It's not so much that what I'm doing is separate, but it's I'm just a little further down the stream of the tradition that we're building together, and then so that I can then
that makes sense. Yes,
and I think that's just facilitation. Like if you've ever, and I'm sure you know people who facilitate journeys or rituals, you know, your work is to see a couple, for me when I'm doing it, because I'm not a reader, right? So I know where we're going, I know how we're getting there, and I'm a couple of steps ahead so that I'm telling people what's where to come, if that makes sense. And so I guess that's just across the board for me is
that makes a lot of sense. I suppose the reason I asked that question and where I was thinking of, again, that piece around, you've just come out with The Ninefold Way of Avalon, which we'll talk about, really the culmination of many, many, many years of practice, lived experience. And so this, is it a, what do we call it? Is it your masterpiece, this? And if so, what's next? Or is it still an evolving process for you?
I think it's a completion.
Right.
So I think, you know, there'll be other things next. I think one is just going to, you know, inform the other. So now this completion is a foundation for what's next, hopefully. I mean, there are other things that I'm working on and towards, but yeah, this is, I feel like I've completed a cycle with this, and certainly this is, you know, yeah, I feel like this is my, if I was to pick the book that was my legacy, I suppose it was this one. I know that sounds a little more grandiose than it needs to be, but yeah, I think that, but I mean, this
it's
is
something well deserved, though.
Developed and worked on very actively for 15 years, with foundations way before that. And then a real intensity to codify it in the way that, you know, it was presented in the book. So
it's not being part of the Avalonian tradition, but of course having connections because of friends of ours. I've seen how it's impacted people in my own life. I've seen certainly through your work how it's been written about and the community that you've built. That 15-year process, I feel like it's a really integral piece. Can you, well, let's start this first. Tell us about the book. What is it? For those people who may be outside of the Avalon tradition, who may see it on the bookstands, and sadly, I have a copy. Marcus sent it to me, but I left it at home this morning, so I can't even show it. But it is on the Llewellyn website. I will put this in the links. Tell us about the book. Tell us about the book.
So first of all, I call it my mullet book. It's got all of the academia in the front and all the woo-woo in the back, the practice in the back. I can't avoid saying that piece. But truly, it's the book that I wish I had when I first embarked upon the path of Avalon. So the front is, you know, I'm looking at what is Avalon? Is it real? Is it weird that people in today's world are, you know, basing a spiritual path on a literary place? You know, there's no proof of it ever actually having existed. So what is that? You know, what's the deal with that, right? To quote one of my co-New Yorkers, you know. But that's the thing. So one of the things that, and you know, I say this is the book I wish that I had, but I know for myself, I needed to have this lived experience. I needed to do my master's program. I needed to have an understanding of how to extract information from story. Because the thing is, you know, and it ties into my archaeology background, story brings lore, story brings culture, story brings so much, even, you know, things that are even unsaid within the tale. And so there are ways of looking at those things, looking at motifs and tracing those motifs back. It's the same process that linguists use to retro create a core language, where language comes from. And so it's the same thing with story. And so, so that piece, looking at the things that make up Avalon. So there are three main currents, I say, in the Avalonian stream of tradition. It is the islands of the other worlds, the ninefold sisterhoods, and the vessels of transformation. And so I trace all of these histories, I trace these symbols, you know, they appear both in lore and in the historical record. I look at the archaeology, and then I look at what do we know about priestesses? What do we know about holy women in Celtic lands, you know, in the pre and post-Christian period? What were they known for? What was their function in society? And then, so to take all of that, and especially that ninefold sisterhood piece, because that for me, I've always known, this is part of that growth piece. You know, the first discussion of Avalon is from Geoffrey of Monmouth, and he talks about how Avalon is ruled by nine sisters, and, you know, and talks about the island and all of these things, but, and he names these sisters and he talks about some of the things that they can do. And it's that information is reflected in a couple of places in Roman histories about these ninefold sisterhoods. So anyway, but I needed to find the ninefold. The names that he gave, we think he created, but they do have some commonality. So I go into all of these things, and what comes out the other side is my experiences of finding the ninefold, how I came to be guided. I don't know, it sounds whatever, but there is a process, and I go into it very deeply about the ways in which the Awen, because the ninefold were like a sisterhood of muses, and anyway, I feel like I'm going.
Up. No, you're not. No.
Oh, okay, thank you. So finding them, and then my process of finding them, then I was able to take that and step by step have people connect with them. And this is the core piece for me as well. I see the nine as a central organizing principle, and we have in the sisterhood for a very long time. The ninefold that we came to, the ninefold that I found is both supported by the lore and facilitated by magical tools, you know, using correspondences, hermetic principles. So again, it's holding two things at the same time. But beyond all of that, it's about, you know, how can we be in service? How can we be a co-creator? If the Awen is that creative force, and the priestesses and any of their functions serve as a doorway between the worlds, that serves as a bridge, serve as a facilitator, you know, over these liminalities. I mean, that's the foundational function. That's the thing that I learned in this process, is that, oh, I understand the foundational principle. It goes through all of the things and it informs so much. So that shifted so much of my ability to be in relationship. And so I took that piece of how can I be a bridge? How can I talk about the ways in which people can be bridges in their lives, be in sacred service? What does priestessing as a verb look like? It's not right. It's something that you do. And there are so many ways to be in sacred service. It doesn't all have to look like the same, you know, the high priestess in the center of the circle, or the teacher, or the herbalist, or the, you know, there are so many different ways. It's the activist, it's the scholar. And that's so very reductive, but it is part of that. And then that idea that if there are these ways of external service, there are all these ways of you know, it's a central organizing principle for the self, a rubric by which we can look at ourselves. Because I think the reason why we see the ninefold so often in lots of Celtic cultures, in Germanic cultures, in Greek cultures, it looks like it's this Indo-European core mythos. And, you know, you can talk about how does it show up in so many places? Is it part of a core myth? Was it diffusion, you know, later after all of the connections, all the diffusion of cultures happened? I don't know, but I think it's connected to what the understanding of the number nine is. And nine is a completion. It's a full set. And we see it show up both in religious context in Celtic and in other cultures, but also in law contexts and in organizational principles. The house had nine sections. The war band had nine people. There was the leader and the eight who supported them in Ireland and so on. There are so many different iterations of it. It makes sense, 9 months to a fulfillment of a pregnancy. So there are reasons for all of these things, but I think that is the key. And so if we're looking, and this is the thing about the Sisterhood of Avalon and the Avalonian tradition as we practice it, is that it does hold two things at once. So it is the lore. What did they do? What do we know? How can we practice? But then there's also the internal reflection. How can we be in relationship now? How can we use this as a tool for transformation, to be sovereign within our inner landscape, to be able to be whole? And in wholeness is related to the ninefold. So what are these nine aspects within myself, right? If there's a lore keeper who path that keeps the histories, when I reflect it within myself, what is my story? What is my history? How did I get here? What do I need to remember? What do I want to sing into being from here? Each of the nine has that inner reflection. So that's the parts of ourselves. It's the way we're in service out in the world, our work in the world, and how we are in relation to the world around us and the people in it and everything else in it. And then our relationship with the divine. So that threefold way. And so this is what it is. And this is why I feel like, it's just shifted everything for me. And I think our path is to be co-creators of the universe. If the Awen comes through us and we speak things into motion, I mean, this is very, Welsh Bardic.
Very much so. Absolutely.
Right? And that the feminine principle, and we could talk about that in a minute, but, you know, serves as the intermediary, whether it's the goddess of sovereignty revitalizes the land, that's creative force energy, whether it's the muse at the cauldron, kindling it with her breath, that is the Awen, that is creation of something, whether it's, the transformative aspects, you know, the grail becomes the cauldron becomes the grail. But now here we are today. What is that? How can we be in this sacred sovereign service? And it is to be that intermediary, to be the bridge of Voben Bidbont, right? Well, I went off on
that. Wow. No, that encapsulates it perfectly. And what really struck out for me, was that piece around coming back to self, right? And just seeing, understanding, not even just seeing, understanding the innate sacredness. This is one of the phases, the journeys in spirituality, at least that I'm seeing, is that people come to spirituality like paganism from a place of disconnection from self. The journey is coming back into self. Okay. I feel like that's what I really appreciate about your book, even if people are not connected necessarily to the stories of Olwen, Branwen, Ceridwen, all the Wens, right? They can still gain that sense of understanding that this is a journey back into self, journey back into sacred internal landscape. That's what I really love about the sisterhood. I must say, like, now that I have you in front of me, is that it isn't about the landscape of Britain that was 2,000 years ago, you know, where the Celts came from and this and all the other. It's that paracosm that anybody can enter into that's already inside. I love that so much.
And I appreciate that. Thank you. And one informs the other. That's the thing.
Yes.
From that. And if I can, one totally. Of the things I find so fascinating about, in the study of religion and the study of culture is that they are, their origins are in the land, right? It's about being in relationship with the land. And I think it's that primal piece. And so when the land is fertile and is mild, that's the culture reflects that, the stories, the relationships with the gods reflect that, the relationships with the world around them reflects that. But in harsh places where there isn't a, you know, I often compare ancient Egypt and, you know, the Mesopotamian cultures and their outlook on the other world, you know, on the afterlife, their relationship to their gods is so drastically different, even though they occupy very similar, you know, place and space. And the difference is the continuity and the reliability of the Nile to give every year. They know, like clockwork, a very, very giving, very reliable system in Egypt. And so they're going to participate in the other world. Whereas in Mesopotamia, they had no such continuity. They could be, you know, there could be floods, there could be, you know, droughts, and, you know, their gods are indifferent to them. So when we understand a land, when we understand a landscape, we understand a people, and we understand their gods. And so I think it's important for us, if we are, I talk about this idea of the stream of tradition, that whether Avalon or the Arthurian piece or divinities themselves, they have an origin, they start somewhere. And their origin is that they're fulfilling a need that the people had to be in relationship with the land or some aspect of their environment. And over time, that relationship shifts, the divinity itself shifts as a reflection of the needs of a culture. And we who are stepping into that stream so far down the line, and for many of us here, at least in the States, we're disconnected from that source of origin. We're not even on the landscape anymore.
Totally.
In order to immerse ourselves in that stream of tradition, we have to go back. We have to have some understanding. And I don't mean you have to go specifically to plan, although you can, but you have to follow it back in the ways that you can, whether that's through lore, whether that's through myth, whether that's through history, some aspect of culture to understand the evolution of that divinity, where they come from, and then understand their story and what they still have to teach us here and now. And then we move forward. We're part of that, I guess, a magical current, if you want to say. And then the story evolves. Because one of the things I love so much about the Celtic divinities is that, you know, or Celtic cultures did not write their sacred things down. They thought it was foolish. When Brennius sacked Delphi, you know, he laughed at the marble gods in these stone houses. How can you create a god? So there's a sense to me that they weren't meant to be static, marble, unmoving figures. You know, we're in dynamic relationship with them. And, you know, there's a story to move forward. I don't think Bladyllith is only what we know in those tales. I don't think she was meant to even be, you know, people, if they had a later, you know, an earlier context for her. I think we're meant to be in dynamic relationship. But in order to do that, we first need to go back. We need to get into the stream so that we can then carry forward with it in this. And the story grows and the story continues.
I really, really hear that. As somebody who, again, grew up over here connecting with these figures, and I've only ever been once back to Wales in the past 30 years, right? It was a long, protracted time, but that resonance, but also seeing the connection points here. And I know mutual friends of ours, Christopher Hughes, for example, one of the stories I love so much that he shared was standing on the Golden Gate Bridge and looking out at the bay and seeing Ceridwen's culture and bawling. And then, of course, police officer comes. Are you okay?
Yes. Oh my god. That's hilarious. I've never heard that one. That is great.
We're not here to laugh about Christopher, but that's just, I love that so much. But that's part of that dynamic relationship because in that moment, emotion, and even in that place of potential danger, Ceridwen's culture in potential danger, there was that support. And I think he spoke about that police officer coming up as a form of Ceridwen. Now, I might just be also inserting, but that piece about that dynamic relationship is really important. So I feel like people can get stuck very much in, and we see it. I mean, let's do a little controversial statement here. We see it in Celtic Reconstructionism, where people get so caught in the past that they don't feel like it can be represented in the landscape. In Obod, that's a big discussion often, and in Druid circles. In your opinion, is there a, how can I ask this? I know what I want to ask you, but I don't know how to ask it respectfully. In your opinion, how does that serve somebody when they're really connected with one thing? What developmental phase does that sit in from your experience? Do you understand what I'm asking?
When people are locked into a
Yeah,
perspective,
when they're really
happening.
connected to a place, when they're really connected to a space, when they're really connected to one form, what do you think is going on there?
I mean, I can't say I have a psychological insight, but I don't necessarily think that is a bad thing if there's growth, because I think that there are a couple of things that come to mind. I mean, sometimes, looking at too many things, shifting around too much, if you only have a mile's worth of gas in you, you can use it to go a couple of feet in many directions, or you can take it down a straight and narrow pathway. And I like the idea of that. Whereas I can, I say that as a Gemini, but I do see there is a power in that immersion. I think it's when we get hidebound. I think it's when we get defensive. I think that's when, because I think there are times when we need to have this semi-permeable membrane to have new things come in. Certainly my perception of the goddesses that I've been in relationship with for, over 35 years has shifted over time. And if I stayed where I was when I started, I could never be in the place that I am here today. So I guess it really depends on the person in there and what they're seeking from the divine and how they're connecting. But I think a lot of people will start there because, well, I think it's two things. Sometimes people start and it's very kind of the sexy Morrigan version of the Morrigan, and then eventually they find the this is the lore-based version of the Morrigan, and then they're so protective and defensive of that vision, and I'm not picking on the Morrigan at all. That was just the first example that came to that. The idea of then it moving again, having had the experience of being wrong or needing to learn, or oh, I've actually found her now, and I'm not going to deviate from that. And there is power in that piece. But I think I don't know that everybody who follows a pagan path is necessarily interested in growth so much. Sometimes there's just a fulfillment in being in a devotional relationship and in doing the rituals and connecting. At least not consciously thinking about it. Like, we're very consciously in the sisterhood, engaging in shadow work, engaging in pushing our boundaries to grow, to shift, to change. But that's not the focus of a lot of people's devotions. They just want to be in a loving, open, maybe connection, or I don't know, other kinds of transactional paganism, we call it sometimes. And so I think it's just, I don't know. I guess you have a thought on that, since you asked the question.
It's something I've been kind of sitting with, and that piece around, I suppose that piece around that facilitation piece, right, is learning to, at least from my own perspective, learning to really honor where people are at,
Oh, absolutely.
and that piece, and so I'm always curious with other authors who've been in the game for a longer time. But I also feel, sorry, go on.
So I can I, if I could just say that one
Totally.
is what where I've come to over the years, because I have facilitated groups for 3 decades. I do my best not to be attached to people's outcomes, right? And so how people perceive divinities, whether they're working with me, whether they're devoted to the same divinities that I am and from a different approach, I offer process, I offer lore, and I'm not attached to what people do with it afterwards. Like, you know better than that, or you're not doing this right, or how could you think that about that divinity? I don't. You get hit with a lot of different stuff over, I'm the reincarnation of this person, or there is, and the way I look at it is someone growing? Are they changing? Is that, I may not personally agree with what they're saying or what they're doing, but it's not my path. So I relieve myself of so much Because it's not my response, you know, obviously a student relationship is a different thing. You want to guide them, but as long as they're not hurting themselves, you know, eventually people will get there. I can't be attached to people's outcomes. And does that make sense? Maybe
no, it totally makes sense. No, it totally makes sense.
Yeah. Not that, you know, your path is your own and you're going to get there when you get there or not, or you'll find something else or what have you, but we're in this moment together. This is, you know, I'm sharing this piece, please do with it what you will. It's like you give somebody a gift. Don't be mad if they rehome it or if they,
exactly.
Can't be attached. That's where I come from. So go ahead.
No, well, it really ties back to what you were saying about service and how that sovereignty piece comes into it. Because from a psychological perspective, oftentimes individuals who have a difficult relationship currently with that idea of sovereignty are very attached to the outcome of other people because they're going through that process of by proxy, right? And so that piece around service does come of letting go. Would you agree?
I do agree. And I think that part of our path towards sovereignty has to include honoring the sovereignty of others.
Absolutely.
Honoring the sovereignty of others. As a facilitator, as a teacher, as a priestess, if someone's going to harm themselves or is it, you know, in a dangerous position, that's a different thing. But overall, if I want to be sovereign and have others honor my sovereignty, I need to do the same for others. And that means releasing my attachment on their experience, on their work.
That makes a lot of sense. So then bringing that back to, this is not a gotcha question, I'm just really generally interested then for the deities that you work with. You know, you talked about Mesopotamian, the Anunnaki before. You talked about how they're very hands-off when it comes to the experiences of some of their people. When it comes to your relationship with the Welsh deities, the various goddesses, that piece about being really hands on them, because the stories are very much kind of put out there as this is their life and this is what they did. And you teach about them as examples and being in relationship with them through examples. What's your opinion then on kind of their role in the process of that service piece and letting go?
Well,
I hope that's not too convoluted a question.
Well, I'm going to answer the question I think you're asking me. One of the things that is perhaps different in Welsh traditions than perhaps Egyptian and Greek and all of these things is that, and again, the same with all Celtic traditions, is that the stories are not written by the people who are in active devotional relationship to these figures. Indeed, in Welsh tradition, none of these figures are even named as divinities. So what we have is, a medieval story where the divinities that are embedded in them have been, reverse euhemerized, we say. So they're no longer divinities. They have connections to the other world, and their stories have shifted. So there are parts of the stories that are about the contemporary culture, and there are streams of those things that are perhaps pre-Christian, and so those are the things that we're looking for. But the stories as we have them are of figures who have evolved over time, about 800 to 1,000 years between the stories being written down and there being active worship. I mean, the language, well, Welsh didn't exist when Britain was pagan. The Welsh language as it is didn't exist when Britain was pagan. So there's a lot of shift, and so there's this time period in between. So what we have are stories about queens, about people, about kings. So there's still nobility and, you know, knights and valiant people, but they're presented as human people or otherworldly people, but they're relatable. The things in their stories are relatable. We're not talking about these vast, universal, Ragnarok and, things that are beyond an everyday experience. We're talking about figures who've gone through, domestic violence, child loss, the horrors and terrors of war, things that are very relatable, especially for the contemporary audience when all of these things were written down. So my experience of these divinities is that as we have received them, they are relatable. They are, some more than others, right? I find it easier, and it was easier to come into relationship with Rhiannon than it was for me with Arianrhod. But still, it's a different kind of a different connection with them. And so but that's where to start, because I think it's a mistake that a lot of people who follow these paths and come to a point where they're like, these stories are flawed. They were messed around with by priests who were trying to keep people from. No, that's not it at all. They evolved in oral tradition and were written down almost literally word for word. I mean, you can tell by some of the phrases in the original language that this was, you know, kind of like a transcript of a bardic recitation. And that's all we have, right? So yeah. It's not like something else. So. And it's such an intricate part of Welsh tradition and culture and a point of, you know, pride and identity, and to throw the baby out with the bathwater on an erroneous assumption, I think is a mistake. So I think it's a place to start where we've received it. Same thing with Avalon. But then we can take that path backward to find that stream of tradition, to find that point of origin, to try to understand what may have come before. And that can help grow your relationship with them. But yeah, I think that I found them to be very relatable because their stories are very relatable.
I appreciate that answer because that was the answer to the question I should have asked and not the thing that kind of came out of my mouth a minute ago. I think we're learning how much I need coffee in the morning, yes. but that relatability is really important. And sorry, that was a really mansplaining way of saying that. I think that relatability is hugely important. So I'm curious then for the Ninefold Way of Avalon. You said, you know, all the academic pieces are at the front and the woo-woo pieces are at the back.
The mullet.
What I experienced is that more of the relatability is at the back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, tell me about that.
Well, it's actually a dynamic process. So I wanted to show where what the lore has to say in the process. One of the things that really surprised me when I was researching is that, you know, some of the assumptions we have about the existence of druidesses, for example, are assumptions that we don't have as much proof of them as we think we do. And so I was like, oh, well, that's uncomfortable, but here it is. So I just shared what it was. So I wanted to try to come from as neutral a position. I mean, I'm following certain threads, but then to put it into action is in the back. That's what it is. And we're reflecting it within ourselves. And how can we be an authentic? How can we find those streams of tradition so that we can do that work to head the way back? So there's that foundation of lore, but then because this is a spiritual path and not, you know, a doctoral dissertation, it's to put that work into practice. How can we connect? How does it relate to me and others in our process, in our own stories and path in this world? And how do I connect to that? How do I do the work to be in relationship with as far back as we can, with the understanding that that empowers us to move forward? Let's
go forward. Absolutely. Absolutely. So with that being said, then, this was a 15-year process for you to bring this to fruition. Now that it's out in there and you have it in your hand, it's completed, at least this version of it. Was there anything that surprised you when you put it out there that wasn't culminating 15 years ago, wasn't even on the radar 15 years ago?
Oh, yeah, so much. Yeah. Again, some of the assumptions that I had, you know, when you looked, because this is the thing. And this is the tool that academia gave me, because I can read a source and you can read a source, but reading the context of that source is just as important. So, for example, one of the things that are cited about the proof of there being druidesses are these second century works from the Roman period. And they talk about three instances where there are these druidesses, named as druidesses, giving these prophecies to Roman emperors or soon to be Roman emperors. So you see, it's in the Roman record. This is what happened. But if you don't know that this series of books that this information occurs in are actually believed to be satirical, and that actual Roman historians don't think that anything in there is supposed to reflect, it's a political piece as opposed to a straight rendering of history, you're going to believe everything that's in that book. And I did. But it wasn't until I understood the context of this thing, because in the same way we have literary, you know, criticism today, and we can analyze a work and what it's actually saying, we have to do the same thing with those source materials. And so, you know, I don't think that's something that, you know, most people consider. It's like, oh, I have the source. It's here. It's in the Roman piece. So, and, you know, that was part of my process as well. So that really kind of shifted things. But that being said, those same tools really served to help me understand things in a way I could never have 15 years ago. And the book that I started writing and the book that I wound up finishing, two completely different things.
Two completely different things.
So, yeah.
Makes sense. No, that makes sense. That piece around context is huge. Mm-hmm. And it is funny. It's not funny. It's interesting how even the lenses that we have at stages of our lives will affect and impact how we understand something.
Oh, gosh. Oh, sure.
Completely, right? Like, yeah, I remember with the Mists of Avalon, for example, mm-hmm. you know, at 14 years old, having stones thrown at me because I was gay in a tiny little town of 8,000 people, and I was made to feel different. Well, yes, of course, I'm going to be really anti-Christian, so the Mists of Avalon, oh, I totally get those pieces, right? That piece around coming back to these same stories again and again and again with different lenses. Mm-hmm. Now that you've placed the Ninefold Way of Avalon out, how do you look at some of your other works that you've put out over the years? You've put out several, well, quite a few, haven't you?
Yeah, I've written 5 books and a deck. Yeah. So actually 6 books, because the book and the deck is pretty, pretty big, a lot of information in it. That said, yeah, I mean, Avalon Within and the Avalonian Oracle were written before I finished my master's. And it's really clear, I think, in the difference. So you can definitely see a progression. So I do wish there were some things I could go back. I go back and I read. I think the practice is sound. But some of the details from my little academic pedant in my head is like, ooh, yeah, I would have probably said that a little differently. Oh yeah, maybe not. I don't think that's or honestly, you know, materials evolve. I mean, archaeology mm-hmm. evolves, you know, history evolves, you know, literary analysis evolves. So, you know, there are just things that we know now that I couldn't have known then. But certainly I've mm-hmm. grown as a scholar, I've grown as a priestess. So I mean, I think that's the thing. We always want to look back and fix. But I think, you know, it's kind of unique position to be in, to have your, you know, your process so publicly available to reflect upon. So that's how I look at it. It's, you know, in the same way that, you know, Celtic studies as a field has evolved since, you know, in the past 100+ years, you know, you look at the materials from, you know, the Victorian period about, you know, Celtic cultures, and you're like, oh, I wish that were true, but that is so, like, I don't even know where you got that from. And people, that's the thing, people will pick that up and be like, well, it says right here, there was a temple to Charon. Oh gosh, I wish there was this temple to Charon. Yeah. I wish that this, but it's so important because it gives us context. It gives us an understanding of the evolution of understanding. And so there's something to be honored around that. And a lot of times there's materials in there, like, the source material is there, and then the research piece is there. Maybe the conclusions are the things that we moved away from, but it's still worth reading those things, but you have to have that, you know, that background perspective. So yeah, I mean, I think anyone is going to, but you can't look back.
Well, you can't look back. You have to look forward. That's true. No, it's true. It's true. It's true. That was a bit of a gotcha question, but I'm always curious for people, especially people who have colleagues of ours who have had such a long kind of publication history, to get that sense of their own progression. Because I feel like a lot of readers, and I've had this with people reading my book, you know, my book's was written 2.5 years ago, literally 2.5 years ago now, and there's stuff in there that I either no longer agree with completely, or there's stories that I've just told so often that they're just like scripts, right? But people picking up these pieces and feeling that, oh, this is set in stone because of where there is that projection piece, right?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
absolutely. So we're actually coming up to time. This has been delightful. I feel like I've been all over the place. So I appreciate you.
I'm happy to meet you.
So my last question then is coming up to the future then. What are some of the things you've got on the horizon? Now this project is done and out there. I know you've privately, at least, you've started working on some of the things. What's next for you? Is there anything you can share with us?
Yeah, there's a couple of things I can't share with you, as you know, those things, how they go. But I'm actually one of the things I'm really excited about. I'll be presenting at the Goddess Conference in Glastonbury again next year, and we'll be back in Wales for a pilgrimage. We'll be in Wales the entire time. But one of the things that I'm really excited about is that I'm turning back towards working on music. And so that's kind of where I'm like starting to lay some roots down. So see what may come, but
Wonderful.
yeah, I'm kind of excited about that.
What, so a harp? Is it a harping that you're doing? Or I remember something somewhere, but I can't remember if it was you.
No, well, I mean, I mostly play guitar these days,
Guitar.
but I've been doing some keyboard instruments, things like that. So I'm gonna be a one woman digital band,
Love
Jenna
it. I
and the
love it.
Machine.
I love it. Well, you've got iconic hair for it, so why not, right? That's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely. I was really, really looking forward to having you on. And I'm glad that you've come on. I can't really say I was really looking forward to it. Oh, well, no, this was delightful. Lack of caffeine. People who are listening to this are probably not think like I don't know. We'll see what people think afterwards. But if people want to get a hold of you or people who are interested, what are some of the things? Do you have any classes coming up that you're teaching? Anything coming up?
Yes. So I have a Journey to Avalon, Walking the Path of the Priestess. I have this online 9-month priestessing course. Well, it's an immersion, but it's not, I'm not teaching you how to be a priestess. It's not like a priestess training course. What it is, I talk about some of the challenges to priestessing in terms of some of the things that I've observed both in myself and in others on how to empower others without worrying and honor each other's sovereignty. So it's a way of approaching that kind of helps with the shadow pieces of leadership and how to be in best service to other people, how to release attachment to their outcomes, so the process that I use, I call it empowerment midwifery. So how to come from a place of sovereignty and encourage and empower others to be sovereign. And so how that ties into service as a priestess.
That's beautiful. And is that within the Avalonian tradition, or is this open to anybody who is priestessing within their
And
own
so
traditions?
that is correct. Yes. It comes from an Avalonian lens. So it is informed by that, but it's not if it is a reflection of the work that we do, but it is open to anyone who wants to look at those things. And I think, people aren't talking about that. There's all that spiritual bypassing. I mean, there are a lot of challenges. And I think a lot of people come to priestessing service or priest service or any clergy really, with all good intentions. And then suddenly people are listening to you. People are interested in what you have to say. People look at you a different way. They put you up on this pedestal. And it's very easy to, as they say, read your own reviews and have this ego, enlargement where it needs to be. When people give you that energy, you need to give it back to them. That keeps them empowered and it prevents you from going down bad places where service becomes intertwined with shadow issues and ickiness. So that was a technical term, ickiness. But so that's what it's about. I think we need to talk about those things to recognize them, to honor them, to see where those pitfalls are and have some strategies to not have them
I'm
poison.
really, really, really glad that that came up. In truth, that thing that I've been seeing now that I've had a chance to speak to many of our colleagues through this, this is coming up to, I think, the 50th episode of my podcast. That theme has been, thank you. That theme has been coming up again and again and again. The exhaustion of that issue, that very real issue, and that very real danger of people stepping into these facilitation roles, either not being prepared for the outcome of that, not being able to differentiate those pieces, and because the conversation hasn't happened, I think that's really important. So I'm really pleased that you're offering that. When is that being offered?
So it starts in February, February
In
1st.
February. Okay, perfect. Well, this comes out just before Christmas time, so people listening, go to, is it going to be on Inner Cephalon or on Genitalium?
They both go to the same place.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll be there. And on all my social media and all of that. But
perfect.
But yeah, and I want to say this, it's not just about the shadow, it's about, you know, a sustainable service as well, so that Absolutely. We don't have that really real burnout. So yes, thank you. And I appreciate your sending people.
No, absolutely. That's really important. I think that's really important. But as I said, I certainly have I've been feeling that since my own book came out. I was chatting to somebody on another podcast a few weeks ago, Devin Hunter. I was chatting to Devin Hunter, and we were talking about that. And I said, you know, the point of real responsibility and freak out for me was having somebody in a class who I suddenly recognized was paying complete attention to me. And that freaked me out, because then it was like, I need to be very, very careful here. Very, very, very careful here. Because if I say something, even from my own place of, you know, like, ugh, that's going to impact that person in a very profound way. So I need to be very, very cautious here. And I feel like, again, more people need to be having those kind of conversations so that people can be prepared for, oh, shit, you know.
Right. Impact is completely enlarged, whether we seek that out or not. And that's part of the archetype of leadership and in our society. And we have to be aware of that and modulate accordingly. So I'm glad that you keyed into that.
Absolutely. No, I am too, because I would hate for me to be on a personal level here, for me to say or do something that I had happened to me with some people in this community years ago. And I think many people do, you know, that moment of going up to that person that you've put on a pedestal, and then for them to turn around and treat you even inadvertently like you were nothing, or, oh, who are you? Like, what? You know, and that feeling of of respect. Anyways, that's a whole other trauma that we'll talk about at another point.
Well, I will say this, you know, even the more benign things, people will say to me, oh, 20 years ago, I saw you, blah, 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 and you said this. And I was like, oh my gosh, but it's unbelievable. So yeah. So be conscious of that. It's
very true. Conscious. Absolutely. Very conscious. Jenna, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the Ochendauerjaun.
Is it Pringhaun yet? I don't know.
I don't know. We'll have to ask Owen and his panas.
I'm in the pagan section now of Duolingo. It makes me very happy. They talk about gods and goddesses and archdruids.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
Oh, yes. But yes. Oh. Bendithion, thank you so much. It's just been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And so this will be going out in, we recorded this first week of December. This will be going out in the next 2 weeks at some point. So for those who are listening and who are interested in finding out more, you can find all of these, all of the links in the show notes. Go and check out the course starting in February. Go and check out The Ninefold Way of Avalon. Beautiful, huge book. I think it's one of your largest, isn't it? And that's available now.
4 pages. Yeah.
Wow.
And I took a lot out.
As is our way, right? So thank you so much. It's available through Llewellyn now. And of course, go and if you enjoyed the book, go and leave a review. I keep looking at myself. Go and leave a review on Amazon, or Barnes & Noble, wherever, Goodreads, because it does help the algorithm. And we always appreciate it. I've been Ben Stimson. This has been the wonderful, fabulous Jenna Tellandrew. And I hope everyone has a good rest of the day.